Gotcha.
Hi guys. Oh, you look so good today. Hi, my name's Jordan. This is Jorge. This is Jen. We're from the Harvard DARPFUR Action Group. And we just wanted to tell you about a divestment campaign that we're running here at Harvard that you guys can help us with.
So last year, Harvard had a successful but only partial divestment campaign. Unfortunately, our university still has stock in a oil company called Sinopec, and it totals $8.4 million.
So we're urging the Harvard Corporation to divest comprehensively from Sudan, and that's where you come in. We have a petition at harvarddivest.com. It takes about 3 seconds. Just write your name, house, email. We promise we won't spam you. And everything you need to know is on the website. And we'll be outside after class with postcards you can send to the White House. Thanks, guys.
And I'd just like to add to this, for those of you specifically who are not taking Psychology 1508, the Psychology of Leadership, after spring break, we're gonna have a guest lecturer. His name is Jesse Sage, and he works for an organization called the American Anti-Slavery Group. It's www.iabolish.com. And he's going to come, he's young, he's class of, I think, 97. But for the last 10 years, he's been working on issues like Sudan, on slavery throughout the world. And he's going to be a guest lecturer here. He's going to talk about this campaign. He's going to talk about what student leaders have done, what he himself has done since graduating from here. So I will send out an email when he comes and speak also to this class, and I highly urge you to hear his story. It's a great story of leadership and also a sad and humane story that's going on, that's unfolding right now around us. Before I continue, there are two other announcements. The first one is coming on stage right now.
Inevitably, you'll be back again.
Cause you know in your heart, babe, our love will never end, no, no. Whoa, whoa. No, 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 no. Oh, 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 yeah. Oh, 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 no. Ooh, baby, always be my baby. When your days and your nights get a little bit colder, whoa, 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 whoa. Baby, believe me, it's only a matter of time, time. Oh, yeah. Oh, hey, yeah. Always be my baby. And we will linger on and on. No. Ooh, baby. Always be my baby. Yeah, yeah. Whoa, oh, never. No, no. You and I will always be. You and I. You and I. You and I will always be. No way you're never gonna shake me. No way you're never gonna shake me. You and I will always be. Always, always, yeah. Do 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 do.
Sorry, Tal. All right. Thank you all very much. We are the Harvard Low Keys. We have our last big concert of the season coming up this Saturday night, March 11th, 8 o'clock, here in Sanders Hall. Only $8 for students, so you can see more goodness like this. Incidentally, we will also be singing at the intermission of the opening night of Chicago, which we'll be announcing soon. If you're interested in tickets for me for the Low Keys concert, I'll be here. Thanks.
All right. Yeah, this has to be under 10 minutes. Yeah. Speak to the microphone.
I just wanted to come talk to you real quick about the show. The show itself, we're actually trying to do something really special with Harvard Theater, and it actually ties in perfectly to Professor Tall's class and in general. A few weeks ago, Professor Tall mentioned centers like Harvard Mental Health are wonderful, but we should have a center to help people discover their passions too. Well, a lot of us in Chicago, yes, that's dirty. A lot of us in Chicago feel that, like, why designate a center when those opportunities to discover your passions are already there? I mean, in IMs, in all the student groups around here, and especially in Harvard Theater. Crew and I, we sort of came up with things that we thought are definitely positive aspects of theater. Teamwork, responsibility, respect, self-confidence, moral support, healthy challenge, social skills, and creativity and imagination. And, you know, and believe me, if you talk to anyone, there's actually three of you sitting here. Stand up, will you guys? There's two right there. David, or Dan, where are you? Dan? There's the three guys, great. You can talk to any of them, and they will say how a magnificent experience this has been. We've done this in 3 weeks, and tonight's our opening night, and we would love it if you were there. Again, the Low Keys are going to be singing at intermission. Last part, we just to show you some pictures. There's no better place to begin establishing a positive, passionate outlook than in putting something like a theatrical play. Professor has shown that those are optimistic even after stumbling. Hell, in theater, we have something called a stumble through, and it's not a pretty thing, but it's an amazing thing in the end. Ultimately end up, you know, more successful and happier than those that settle for the known outcomes. Theater expects you to always be better, fosters the perfect environment surrounded by your peers and other similarly committed and dedicated individuals who, if it's going to be a good show, are right there beside you, helping you help them help themselves, help you help the show. And that's literally what it's like. It's all about helping each other, from the person that takes the tickets to the person that sings the first number. All right, well, We open tonight, March 9th, 8 p.m., Agassiz Theater, Radcliffe Yard. Tickets at the door, only $9 for a show that I guarantee you, you have not seen at Harvard in a long time. Thank you very much.
Okay, for a minute I thought this was Friday night and I was in a Sanders theater a cappella, but I guess not. Just one last thing. Thank you so much, those of you who took this survey here. It helped a lot. Those of you who haven't, I urge you to. It's very important research that can impact the lives of Harvard students and other students in year to come. So I urge you to go there and take the survey. My apologies for starting so late. It will not happen again, I can guarantee. But weren't you thinking of the photographer when this was happening? It's amazing. What is it about me? Must be me. I don't know. I'll have to think about it and improve and change. So just one question that I'll address and then we'll move on. I talked last time about the idea of the fake it till you make it, and remember the William James quote that you can pretend to have a good mood and then over time the mood will overtake you and vice versa for a negative mood. And Greg Price brought up the question after class, isn't this the great deception? You know, what we're trying to avoid here. And I was rereading the William James quote, and yes, it does sound like the great deception. This is certainly not what I'm advocating in this class. As I said, you know, yes, when you want to feel better about yourself, what can help is putting on a smile. What can help is, you know, walking differently. What can help is shaking with confidence. What can help is changing our body and changing our facial expressions. However, that doesn't mean that there is no place and an important place for feeling as we're feeling and for saying it, not wearing our heart on our sleeves necessarily, but with an intimate friend, with a close friend. Now, how are you doing? Well, I'm stressed out of my mind. I have midterms, I have papers, it's not going well for me. That's fine. Now, when we walk out, we can feel that way and give ourselves the permission to be human. Always, always, and I've repeated it so many times in the class, and I'll continue to repeat it, it's a question of balance. It's getting the pendulum from the negative side to somewhere here. I'm not saying, you know, lead our lives putting a smile on our faces all the time. That's not healthy either. Give yourself the permission to be human, to experience the full emotions. And remember that there is research that shows that our body influences how we feel. Let's move on. I know I've gotten many emails and the TFs have gotten many emails about the midterm, and I just want to say a few things about it. The midterm is going to be very straightforward. It's going to be based only on readings and lectures. So in sections, what you went through that reinforced the readings, great, but if it's something that we didn't cover in class, if it's something that you didn't read about, it will not be covered in the midterm. We tried to have uniformity across sections. It didn't work, and we preferred that each TF bring his or her strength to the class rather than try and fit into a prescribed box. So it's going to be very straightforward. It's going to be multiple choice questions, and it's going to be short, objective questions. There's not going to be gotcha. We're not going to expect you to know the nuances of every tiny reading. It's going to be the main points from the readings. And if you want to know what's from the lectures, just follow the PowerPoints and everything that is. We're not going to do anything that I said that the highlight of it didn't appear on the PowerPoint. So let's say if there was a study that I spoke about, that's fair game. You know, if it's a study that I mentioned and didn't have a slide about it, you know, with the name of the person who did it, we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to have it on the midterm. Very straightforward, no gotcha. Do the reading, go over the lectures, and you're more than fine. Let me also say a few words now about the final project. Also, I've gotten many emails about this. Again, to reiterate what I said at the beginning, and I'm going to put a document up on the website, so there's no need to take notes, but just so you know, any topic within positive psychology, it could be something that we've discussed in class or something that we haven't. If you're interested in spirituality, which we haven't touched on in depth in class, or religion, you know, many of you are interested in religion and happiness, by all means, do that. If you're interested in doing gratitude, which we did touch in class, that's perfectly fine too. It's your own presentation. It's what you want to pay forward, what you care about most deeply. The text will be 10 to 5 double-spaced, which is about the 20 to 30-minute presentation. Have slides either in Word or PowerPoints. You can be creative. You can use what, you know, what I did, you know, similar presentations or similar style, or find your own. In it include reference to research. Remember, bridging the ivory tower in Main Street, rigorous research that you can then communicate to other people. If you want, use stories, film clips, exercise, whatever your style is. In terms of the dates, when these things are due, by March 23rd, just let your TF know the topic, just what you're thinking about, what you're interested in. Just want your mind to begin thinking about it. Any topic. By the way, and if you decide a week later to change it, no, it's not inscribed in stone. Just what you're thinking about doing by March 23rd. By April 7th, send your TF a one-page outline, just a draft. By the way, these parts of the project are not graded. You just need to hand them in. Just like the response papers, you need to hand them in. One-page draft of your ideas so that your TF can respond to it, or you can talk about it, or just for you to start the process, so it's not a last-minute night before paper. Very often when you get in this one page, throughout the course, you suddenly hear, oh, this research is relevant. Oh, I want to do further reading about this. This is why I want you to start thinking about it relatively early. By May 10th, so hopefully way before, but by May 10th, you will give the actual presentation with the PowerPoints or with the Word file or whatever you're using as slides to 3 or 4 other students from your section. And you'll be divided into groups later on in the semester. This is not graded. It's for you to give it to them and to get feedback on it so that it can improve. Because ultimately, first of all, because you want to share this information with other people to pay it forward. But second also, so it gives you an opportunity so that the next round, when you give it to the greater public, it will be more polished. And then by May 17th, a week later, the final project will be due. And the final project, as I said, will be the PowerPoint slides and the written text. Any questions about this or the midterm? Thesis writers, you can take it after spring break. Any thesis writers here? What are you doing here? Good for you, good for you. Yeah, I didn't go to any class before my thesis was due, but great. Any questions? Yes. Sorry? No. Oh, no, you mean this, the final project? The final project is only the PowerPoint slides and the text. It's not you actually giving it. No, absolutely not. No, this is not a rhetoric class. But as I said, I hope, and many people from last year have done it, give this lecture to others, whether it's in your summer program or to your family. Again, pay it forward. This is important information. Any other questions? Okay, yes. Is the text an essay? It's somewhere in the middle. It's it's actually your speech. It's like you're writing a speech, as if you would be reading it. Yeah. Okay, but it's important to have the reference like you would for a psychology paper or other papers here. All right? So, let's move on and talk about exiting our comfort zone. In order to change, it is very difficult, it is impossible to change if we remain within our comfort zone. Change happens, the behavioral type of change happens when we exit it. However, there are a few things to keep in mind when we exit our comfort zone, and that is to attain the optimum levels of discomfort. What does that mean? So for instance, what I did on Tuesday, which I hope you remember, or I hope you don't remember, rather, I got out of my comfort zone, I really did. But for me, it was the optimum levels of stretch. Why? Because, you know, we know each other already by now. You know that I can be silly once in a while. It was okay. It wasn't like I came out of the blue and, you know, displayed my catwalk skills, right? So there was some context to it. Also, if you remember, I timed it perfectly. It was on Tuesday, right? When was the last ad drop date? Too late, sorry. So it wasn't a real risk in that respect. But when we think about the optimum levels of arousal, we can think about it, and Jeff mentioned it in his presentation last week. We can think about it, if this is the arousal, as three levels. The first level here would be low levels of arousal. This is our comfort zone. This is medium levels of arousal. This would be stretch, right? The stretch zone. And the highest level would be the high, as Jeff mentioned, would be our panic. You know, so I was somewhere here on the verge, almost panicked, but just below. This is the optimum. This is where change happens. If you want to think about it in terms of a metaphor, think of water. When low, the comfort zone, this would be freezing water. Freezing water doesn't move. There is no change. This would be the flow of water. And we're going to read about flow next week. Here would be boiling. Now, the problem with boiling, there is a lot of change here, but it's impetuous. It's uncontrollable. It's not as safe. And when we are here, if we do decide to be here, very often we need supervision. We need help from other people. Let me give you an example of the three levels. Let's say you want to get fitter. You want to work on your physical fitness. Low, the comfort zone would be a couch potato. You know, watch the TV, continue to do nothing about the fitness. That's comfortable. That's what I've been doing until now. I'm going to continue doing it. The medium, the stretch. This would be starting gradually. Running, let's say, 1 mile at a slow pace today, next week running 1.5 miles and building it gradually. The high would be going out for a 10-mile run this afternoon after not having run for a long time. It's an unhealthy form of change. Think about it also in terms of working on your flexibility. Doing nothing, remaining in the comfort zone, won't lead to any change. Stretching too hard can lead to a tear in the muscle. Medium, it's slightly uncomfortable. Those of you who are athletes know, it's slightly uncomfortable. You pull a little bit out of your comfort zone, and that's how you improve your flexibility over time. Tiny tinge, not too much. For every person, this is different. You have to find your own for every area. Another example, speaking up in class or giving public lectures. Comfort zone for most people is not to do it, to speak to friends. Panic zone would be standing in front of, you know, 850 people right from the word go. Stretch would be building it up gradually. First of all, giving to 3 or 4 people. Speaking up in section, joining Toastmasters, or whatever it is, and then gradually over time building it. This is the healthy approach to change. Sometimes it is necessary to go to the high, to do it immediately. For example, drug addiction. You can't say, or it's very difficult to say, well, I'm going to gradually stop taking drugs. Very difficult. It's there, it's almost all or nothing. But then you're here, and that's exactly why very often we need supervision. Because everything is boiling, everything is, there's a lot of unexpected, unknown. And that's why we need help, we need supervision, when we are, when we have to go to the high, to the panic zone. The important thing, the key here, is to do it. I mentioned it last time, it's very rare that people enjoy lasting change if they don't follow up their attitudinal change, the realization, the understanding, with action. Let me share some examples. You want to work on your self-esteem. Yeah, one of the things you can do is read Nathaniel Brandon. You can even do his sentence completion, some of the exercises that he gives. But ultimately, self-esteem doesn't come from reading about it, nor from standing in front of the mirror. It's not enough. Self-esteem comes when we cope, when we go out, we get out of our comfort zone, when we take some risks, when we speak up in class, even though you can hear, we can hear our heart beating in our heads. It's taking risks and going up to someone, a man or a woman, and asking them, what are you doing this Friday night? Do you want to go to the Lowkeys concert? How about Chicago? How about taking some photographs together? Okay. After Chicago. So, as you see, there are many possibilities and opportunities here at Harvard for... The thing is, and here is the key, when we take risks, it doesn't matter whether they say yes or no. Yes, it matters for the initial up or for the initial down, but then we go back to our base level. Ultimately, it's the doing it that increases our self-esteem over time. It's the coping that increases our self-esteem over time. Why is that? Remember self-perception theory? I mentioned it last time, that we evaluate ourselves as if we were an outsider looking in. And if I see myself going up to someone and asking her or him out, what is this saying about me? It's saying, oh wow, this is a person with courage. And that's how I evaluate myself, and my self-esteem increases as a result. Remember the shy people in the Zimbardo and Hemmerly study that I mentioned last time. Okay, so they saw themselves succeeding. But in the real world, we rarely get, 12 out of 12 yes, as they got in that room. But if we try enough, then we will get a yes. Our self-esteem will increase whether we get the yes on the first go or whether we get 5 no's before we hear a yes. Remember, the most successful people in the world are also the people who failed the most times. No coincidence. They take risks, they cope, they go out of their comfort zone. This is a key issue that I'll talk about a lot next week. One of the main reasons why we are so stressed, why anxiety levels are so high, is because we feel overwhelmed, because we are doing too much. This is not easy to reverse that, to say no. But if it's important to remember that very often when we say no to others or we say no to opportunities, we're saying yes to ourselves. That's not easy because we don't want to, first of all, hurt others if saying no would mean hurting them, or giving up opportunities, and there are so many wonderful things to do. But if we want to reduce stress, we cannot do everything. Quantity ultimately affects quality. More on that next week. And finally, the gratefulness exercise, such a simple exercise. Doesn't take long, a few minutes. With such physical and mental positive effects. Finally, do you know how many times I have walked the stage in my pink shirt before I actually did it here? Many times. Why? To expose myself to it, to do it gradually, because the mind doesn't differentiate between the imaginary thing and between the real thing. So I saw myself doing it over and over again, and when I actually got to do it, well, I've done it before. It was still in my strike zone, but much easier than it would have been had I just done it. Imagine yourself doing things. Use the power of the mind. See yourself speaking up in section. See yourself trying out for a play. See yourself going up to someone and asking them out. Let me move on to cognition. Remember the ABC, this is the last one. And with each one, what we do is we look at the gradual approach to change and the acute approach to change. With cognition, the gradual approach to change, I'll just briefly touch on it because we have discussed it in great length. Cognitive reconstruction, interpretation of the same event in a different way. Each interpretation in itself is a neural pathway. If we learn to interpret things, if we learn to generalize negative events, this will always be the case. If we learn to make them, or rather, I'm always like this, pervasive, it's always will be like that. Or we have the all or nothing, or we have discounting the positive and other cognitive distortions, that's a neural pathway that over time is reinforced. And our goal is to create positive neural pathways based on this cognitive reconstruction. We talked about the world according to the fault finder. Remember, I told you a story. Everything that I told there was accurate about my being ADD, about my failing from first from Cambridge, then from Harvard, earlier from high school, through the lens of the fault finder. And then I told you the same story, the exact same events from the lens of a merit finder. Same external event, different neural pathways. And over time, if we interpret or learn to interpret it, these rivers, these channels will become larger if we learn to interpret it more positively. But it takes practice and it takes time. Let me tell you a story that's often told in psychology textbooks to make the point of to make a point about identical twins. So you remember the identical twin studies that said that change is essentially impossible because the twins are so similar. So one thing we talked about is that they were making the error of the average. Most identical twins, reared apart, are similar, certainly not all. And here is a story that captures how they can be different and why. The story is about identical twins who had a father who abused them, also abused his wife, was constantly drunk, treated them and their mother miserably. These kids somehow make it through childhood. They grow up, they become adults. When they're 35, a psychologist goes to visit them. First he goes to one of the twins, and that twin is drunk, uses dangerous drugs, had a family, but abused his wife and children. They left him completely alone and miserable. The psychologist spent some time with the twin, and after a while, finally a moment of soberness, he gets to ask the twin his questions, and he asks the twin, why are you like that? Why are you doing this to yourself, to which the twin responds, what else do you expect? How can you expect me to be any other way? You know my father. The psychologist nods and says, I understand. Because in psychology, we know how much upbringing influences our behavior, especially the early years. Despondent, the psychologist goes to the other twin. Comes to the other twin's home, and there is light. The twin welcomes him in, presents, this is my family, wonderful wife, wonderful children, living happily. And the psychologist is stunned, and he says to the twin, how did you do this? To which the twin responds, what do you expect? Have you seen my father? Do you expect me to be any other way? The exact same events, external events, very different interpretations. With the first twin, it's resignation. With the second twin, it's, I'm going to make my life different. I'm going to be a different dad. I'm going to be a different husband. I don't want to have that kind of life. Now I'm simplifying it. It's not simple. It is very difficult to get out of patterns that have been imposed on us as children. But it is possible, and many people do it. And this story captures the essence of it. Same external events, very different neural pathways created as a result of this event. And it takes time to change, but it is possible. It is possible if we're conscious, and I know many of you have emailed me about this, saying how you suddenly catch yourself with an interpretation style. Oh, I'm overgeneralizing here. Oh, I'm doing the all or nothing thing. Oh, I'm discounting the positive. Let me appreciate the positive more. Let me see things for what they are. It's possible, but it takes time. It takes time and it takes hard work. Let me give you some examples of cognitive reconstruction. Everything that I'm giving you here, all the examples that I'm giving you here are taken from literature, and they're things that I personally have used. I never teach anything or give any assignment that I haven't done myself. These things work, they've worked for me and they've worked for many other people. We can construct a situation, this exact same situation, whether it's an exam at Harvard, an audition for a play, going up to someone and asking her or him out. We can construct it as either threatening situation or as a challenging situation. Tomaka and her colleagues did the study where they asked people to think about an event, a threatening event, such as an exam. And one group had to think about it as threatening. Oh no, the midterm's coming up. The other group got the instruction to think about it as a challenge. And they measured them physiologically, and there was distinct physiological differences between the two groups. Both were excited, but one group was anxious, much more anxious than the group that constructed it as a challenge. It's possible to do almost with every event, not every event, but almost with every event that's coming up. How can we construct it as a challenge? Ask yourself, what is it in your life? Again, the midterm is an easy example, but what else in your life can you learn to perceive as a challenge? It applies to relationships. It applies to work. It can apply to athletics, of course, any area. Very simple, you know, the switch can come in a second. And over time, when we make this switch over and over again, a new neural pathway is created. When there is a challenge, it's no longer perceived as a threat as much as a challenge. This is one of the classic studies. Those of you who have taken Psych 15, surely know about this study. Study on attribution theory, one of the most important ones by Schechter and Singer. Here is what they did. They brought the subjects into a lab, telling them that they will take part in a study. But before they took part in the real study, which was not the real study, again, there was deception there, before they took part in the study, they were given an injection which they were told was just a vitamin injection. Actually, what the injection was, this was back in 1962, they couldn't have gotten away with it today, what the injection was epinephrine. Epinephrine raises our adrenaline levels, raises our arousal level significantly. And then they divided them randomly into two groups. The one group, when they were in the waiting room, waiting for the real experiment, had to fill out a questionnaire. And there was a Confederate also sitting there. The questionnaire had questions that would irritate them, that would normally make them angry. For example, one of the questions was, remember 1962, how many men has your mother slept with before she got married? Again, I don't think they would get away with it, you know, with today ethical standards. But that was one of the questions. And next to them was a Confederate who got really upset. You know, started saying obscenities about who the beep do they think they are, and so on. So, what happened to the person? The person got angry, and much more angry than other people who didn't have the epinephrine before. In other words, they interpreted their arousal level, adrenaline, excitement, they interpreted it as anger, and they really got angry there. The second group had it different. The second group went in and took a questionnaire with no offensive questions. And there was a Confederate next to them who was in a great mood, had the hula hoop and was playing around with the hula hoop and laughing and telling jokes. And they evaluated their levels of arousal after. And these people were happier as a result of this, and happier than people who weren't administered the epinephrine before. In other words, they interpreted their high arousal levels to happiness. Similar physiological reaction with the epinephrine, interpreted differently based on the external events. So yes, they actually did become happier. Yes, they actually did become angrier. But very similar physiological responses. The question of interpretation. Now, in real life, hopefully we will not be subject to this kind of experiment, but the question is, what do we focus on? There's good and bad in everything. If we focus on the negative and our arousal levels are slightly high, we're much more likely to be anxious and upset and angry. If we focus on the positive things in life, if we're more of merit finders, then this higher arousal level is much more likely to be interpreted as excitement, which is related to the first challenge versus threat. It's inevitable that during exam period or midterm period or paper period, arousal levels are higher. Inevitable. Human beings. That's, again, unless the Dalai Lama was here, you know, he could have maybe kept the same level. But we all respond to it. The question is, do we respond to it positively or not? And a lot of it, not all of it, but a lot of it is up to us. Another example. This is an experiment that was done by Ross and Samuels, professors from Stanford. And what they did was the following. They asked students to identify friends of theirs who were the most cooperative people that they knew, who volunteered the most, who they thought were the goodest, so to speak, who did the most good. And then they asked them to also identify the most competitive, you know, cutthroat kind of friends that they had. And they got these people who were identified as cooperative versus, you know, cutthroat competitive. And they brought them into the experiment, and they had them go through some of the prisoner's dilemma. Some of those of you, the economists here, know some of these exercises that are played between partners. And they wanted to see how cooperative these people really were versus how competitive these people really were. But here is the intervention. Randomly dividing this group into two, putting some cooperative and some competitive individuals together, putting some competitive and cooperative individuals on the other group. One group was told that the game was a community game. They were told that it was called a community game. The second one, the second group, was told that it was a Wall Street game. At the end, there were people who behaved more competitively, and there were people who behaved more cooperatively. What predicted it? Only whether they were put in the competitive game or in the cooperative game, not their friends. Their friends couldn't predict whether they would behave one way or the other. The only thing that predicted it was whether they were put in a community game or a Wall Street game. Remember the priming ideas that we talked about. Little things. Think about it for your life. Where can you apply this concept of how you perceive, whether it's friendships, relationships? You know, there are people who perceive relationships as a competition versus a cooperation, consciously or subconsciously. How we frame, cognitively frame a situation influences our behavior to a great extent. Also, as a leader, how do you frame situations for your team, for your group, in the future, for your organizations? And that can make all the difference, much more so than dispositional factors of this person is just a nice cooperative fellow versus a competitive cutthroat individual. Lisa Leroux, one of my students, wrote her sophomore paper on trying at Harvard to cognitively reconstruct volunteering, not to look at it as a duty, but rather as a privilege. And there's research that shows that people who are able to do it, or situations where parents are able to get their children to look at volunteering as a privilege, they're much more likely to volunteer. Significant implications for education, for child rearing, for leadership in general. Relationships. This, you're going to read this paper for the week on relationships at the end of the semester, but I want to introduce it now because it is so important, so I don't want to just touch on it once. Schnark, who is a couples therapist, researcher, has done a lot of work on this topic. Ask the simple but difficult research question, which is, how can you sustain long-term relationship? How can you sustain passion once the honeymoon phase is over? And what he found consistently with relationships that have gone well over time is that the difference was between individuals who were there to be validated, I want you to tell me how wonderful I am, I need you to tell me how wonderful I am, versus relationships where the individuals were in it to be known, to be understood. In other words, where the individuals were not there to impress, but rather to express. Think about your relationships, and that's not just for romantic relationships. What Schnark found was that for intimate, long-term relationships, not just between romantic couples, also between friends, the most intimate relationships are ones where we go in wanting to express who we are. What am I about? Who am I? Wanting to be known versus going in there to be validated. Also think how much easier it is going into a relationship, whether it's a first date or, you know, a three-year relationship. How much easier, more pleasant it is to go in there saying, This is who I am. And you know what? When we go in to be validated, it's potentially a lose-lose situation. Why? Because, you know, maybe they won't like us or that image that we were trying to put forth. But also if they do like that image, it's not us who they like. They like that image. And the other lose there is that it exacts a very high psychological price to put on a show, to not be ourselves, to try and be someone we're not. In contrast, if we go in there and we are ourselves, all we can do is win. If they don't like it, well, then they don't like who that person is. Their loss. But at the same time, we haven't lost ourselves. Now, what is a man if he loses his soul? You know, who are we if we lose who we are? It's a win-win. The final one that I want to talk about, and one which I'll elaborate on extensively in the perfectionism lecture, how do we perceive failure? As a stumbling block or a stepping stone? This is critical. And as I said, this is something that I've been working on a great deal. And now automatically, there's a neural pathway right here that immediately when there is a failure, okay, so what can I learn from it? Not to the exclusion of difficult experiences and not to the exclusion of experiencing it, giving myself the permission to be human, but it's much more automatic. The last one that we will talk about today, I won't talk about it, is how do we see our work as exercise or chore? And for that, I'd like to invite Ellie Crum, who is a teaching fellow. She graduated, she took 1504 last year, and she wrote a thesis, her senior thesis, with Professor Langer, whom you've met often in this class, and with me. And her research, I think, more than any other research that I've seen, gets to the essence of reconstructing a situation and having different results. The thesis is an award-winning thesis, and it's a thesis that will be published very soon. So I want Ali to talk about her research.
Does that work? Can you hear me? Awesome. No? Well, I can't sing, nor do I act, but and I obviously can't do tall catwalk justice, but it's an honor to be here and to speak about my work. It was such a blessing to be able to take tall's courses, and I'm so happy that you get this opportunity as well. So essentially, the original idea came from Dr. Ellen Langer, who questioned whether or not the benefits of exercise were due to the placebo effect. While this was a bold question at first, the more I thought about it, the more I realized it was a logical question to ask. If the placebo effect accounts for up to 40% of any pharmaceutical drug, why wouldn't it have a similar effect on behavioral medication such as exercise? And given my background on the mind-body connection and experience with it, as well as reading several of the studies on the power of our mind on our bodies, I decided to take the idea and run with it. And thanks to Tal here, Professor Tal, and Phil Stone, I was able to use it as my thesis. So specifically, I worked with 84 room attendants working in 7 different hotels, 3 of which were in the Boston area and 4 of which were in my home state of Colorado. I chose this population because these women were getting an extraordinary amount of exercise throughout the day, cleaning rooms, vacuuming, pushing carts, changing linen, picking up wet towels, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I had a feeling that they did not view their work as exercise, and I wondered whether or not this had an impact on their physiological state. So in the first set of measures, I went in and looked at their perceived levels of exercise, as well as their psychological and physical measures of health that are known to be associated with exercise. The first results were interesting in and of themselves. These women, although they are getting an extraordinary amount of exercise, did not view it as exercise. And unfortunately, their physiological health reflected these perceived levels of exercise rather than the actual levels of exercise. They had extraordinary levels of obesity, high blood pressure, nearing hypertension, and on the whole had a lot of anxiety and depression issues as well. So the next task was to change their mindset. So specifically what I did was went in and gave a 15-minute presentation on how their work was good exercise. I told them, you know, how many calories they're burning vacuuming and how many calories they're burning pushing carts, and sort of talked about, you know, the different muscles they were using and let them know that the work they were getting far exceeded the Surgeon General's requirements for an active lifestyle, which is specifically to accumulate at least 30 minutes of physical activity throughout the day. So I just gave that simple 15-minute presentation and also had it put up on their bulletin board in the form of a poster so that they could be reminded of it each day they went to work. And then 4 weeks later, I came back and measured them again on their perceived exercise and their psychological and physiological health. And predictably, they had changed their cognitive interpretation of their work from seeing it simply as work to now seeing it as good exercise. And remarkably, they had pretty powerful changes in their psychological and physical health. They had improved levels of body image satisfaction, improved anxiety, depression, showed on average a 2-pound weight loss, a 0.5% reduction in body fat, and a 10-point drop in systolic blood pressure. These are small changes given the state of health that they were in, but significant statistically as well as considering that it was only within a 4-week time period. Inevitably, the next question that people ask is, well, how did such a simple presentation have such significant impact? Some, like Ellen Langer, say it's simple. You put the mind in the body, you put the mind in a healthy place, the body will follow. Others, like Professor Stone, would argue it must have been moderated by some sort of change in behavior. I tried to account for, you know, significant changes in behavior, but it was likely that they could have put more oomph into their vacuuming or changing linen. In any case, I attribute it to, number one, a change in cognitive interpretation, and number two, initiating them on the spiral of affect, behavior, cognition, throw in the physiology in there. What's important is initiating it and sustaining it in a positive direction. So, that's that. No catwalk, sorry.
So I remember when the results came in, and even though, you know, I've read this literature, I know about this literature, I was stunned, absolutely stunned about these results. With a simple change of interpretation, your work really is exercise, physiological, and so these are very objective. I mean, Ali measured what, heart pressure, weight, actual weight, body fat. I mean, these things actually changed as a result of this, and also on psychological measures, they became. Their levels of well-being went up. Amazing, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, how did this compare to the control group? The control group had no significant changes. Yeah, oh, significant, yeah, I mean, absolutely. It was compared to a group that was measured before the 4 weeks and after the 4 weeks, no significant change. Again, the usual fluctuations, as you point out, but no significant positive change. It takes time to form new neural pathways. Sometimes a 15-minute presentation can be enough. Sometimes a click of saying, I'm going to look at this as a challenge rather than a threat. This is an opportunity, rather than as a disaster. These can start a positive spiral of growth. Let me move on now to the more acute change when it comes to cognition, the eureka experience. The eureka experience, one of the most misunderstood concepts in psychology, the aha moment, when a lightning strikes and we suddenly see it. Suddenly we understand, we have that insight. misunderstood because people think that what the Eureka experience is about is taking a hammer and it happens suddenly, a quick fix. It's not. There is a process that has been documented over many years, and the process has five steps of taking the Eureka experience and making it real significant change. The first step has to be the preparation, the immersion. Immersing oneself in the topic. So for example, Mozart or Beethoven, before they were creative, before they had the Eurekas for a great symphony, for a great piece, they first put in many years of hard work, of learning music. So for Mozart, it didn't take as long as for most people. But if you look, for example, at Beethoven, those of you who listen to his symphonies, the first two symphonies, almost indistinguishable from anything that Mozart wrote. But then when he gets to the third symphony, Eroica, it's entirely different. That's when the creative spark, the Eurekas, begin to come in. But many years of preparation before Martha Graham, who redefined what dance is all about, had studied many years conventional dance before she was able to break out of the mold, to think out of the box, to be creative. Takes a long time, much preparation. Howard Gardner, professor at the Ed School, says, estimates that it takes 10 years for people, it's a rule of thumb, he says, but 10 years for people to actually learn a domain before they're able to push the envelope, to have creative ideas. So the first step is immersion, reading about the topic. Think about it when you write a paper before you have the aha. You read about it, you understand, and then you have, okay, so this is the unifying theme for my paper, 10 minutes before it's due. Then the incubation. Ideally, what we want is to have the idle time for the mind to make the connections. So there's a lot of information here. We need this incubation time for the mind to have to make the connections. It is no coincidence that many of our great ideas come when we're in the shower or shaving or driving a car mindlessly. When we have idle time. One of the biggest problems in today's world is that we don't have enough idle time. I talked about earlier about the importance of simplifying. One of the greatest entrepreneurs, creative geniuses in the realm of business, J.P. Morgan, said this. He knew that he needed idle time to take time off in order to maximize his productivity. This is very rare today, especially if you're working for J.P. Morgan or Morgan Stanley. He wouldn't have approved, because we can be great mechanics when we don't have time, but we can't be highly creative. Big difference between the two. Think about it when you're a leader of an organization. Think about it in your life. How can you simplify? How can you say more no's so that you're saying yes to yourself? Because it makes a difference. It's like in bodybuilding. You need to rest the muscles for them to build up. There's no coincidence that etymologically the word creation and recreation are connected. There is a real metaphysical connection between them. When we recreate, we're much more likely to be creative. Finally, after the preparation, after the incubation, and again, it doesn't always work this way, but generally this is the process. After that, there's the Eureka experience, the insight. Aha, now I get it. All the neurons come together to one unified idea. This can feel like a peak experience. To use a metaphor, we can think of what goes on between the sheets. So preparation and incubation is like the foreplay. Eureka is like the orgasm. It happens. But remember, this is especially directed at the men here. Foreplay is important. Idle time? After. It's very, all right, can we leave the realm of sex for a minute, please? Let's go back to the aha experience, the eureka experience. There are no shortcuts. There are no quick fixes. I asked you to leave the realm of sex for a minute, didn't I? Stage one and stage two has to come before stage three. Why is everyone smiling? I mean, this is a serious psychological research. And why am I blushing? So after the eureka experience, we get to... I didn't think about that, actually, until now. Well, actually, I did think about it. So this is when you are wonderful. You were great. The best I've ever... Okay. At this stage, you see, there are many great ideas out there, many eurekas, but not all great ideas can be translated into something that is concrete, that is actually useful. This is when we ask the following question.
Is this a lasting treasure, or just a moment's pleasure? Can I believe the magic in your eyes? Will you still love me tomorrow?
This is when we ask, so is this really a great idea? Or, because there are many eureka experiences that are not worth elaborating on, that don't stand the test of reality. And finally, after we have concluded that it does stand the test of reality, we elaborate on it. This is when we communicate it coherently to others. For example, the way I put 1504 together. Initially, a great deal of preparation, immersing myself in the material. Some of it happened through being Professor Stone's TF for 2 years in positive psychology seminars. Once was teaching a sophomore tutorial in the psychology department based solely on positive psychology, or primarily on positive psychology. Then, when Professor Stone told me, you're going to be teaching this class, I immersed myself in the material for over 3 months, just read, morning to night. I read the Handbook of Positive Psychology, which is about this thick. I read journal articles. And as a result of that, I had ideas because I took time off during the months when I was preparing, and also after I took 2 weeks off when I didn't touch the material. And it was during these 2 weeks that I came up with ideas such as the PPEO, post-peak experience order. I suddenly said, aha, I got it. And then I started to evaluate it, looking for research about it, and suddenly I saw, yes, there is research about it, some of which I'll talk about in a few minutes. And the elaboration was, for me, writing down these ideas as coherently as possible, and now I'm communicating them. Going through this process, it wasn't just one day I woke up and said, oh, this is what I'm going to teach in positive psychology. There are no shortcuts. I'll show it some other time. I have a video clip, but I want to get through this material. I will show it. It's from Monty Python. Do I have to show it now? It's a 3-minute clip. Anyway, who says no? All right. Tell you, I've been voted down. Monty Python captures the creative process.
Good afternoon and welcome to a packed Olympic Stadium Wimbledon for the second leg of this exciting one. And here come the Germans now, led by their skipper, Nobby Hegel.
They must surely start famous this afternoon. They certainly attracted the most attention from the press of their team problems. And let's now see their lineup. The Germans playing 4-4, Leibniz in goal, back four, Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, and Schilling, front runners, Schlegel, Wittgenstein, Nietzsche, and Heidegger, and the midfield hero, Beckenbauer, and Jasper. Beckenbauer also has been a surprise. And here come the kicks, led out by their veteran center half, and a Kleibniz. Left foot of that team, as it's expected, a much more defensive lineup. Faker is in goal, Pocket is a front runner there, and Aristotle has to be by Aristotle, very much the man in form. One surprise is the doing of Archimedes. Well, here comes the referee, Kung Fu Tzu Confucius, his two linemen from the government and first comes the lineup. And as the two skippers come together to shake hands, we're ready for the start of this very exciting final. Referee Mr. Confucius checks his plan, and they're off! Meet your name, Oliver. Carl Kessler from the outside, sit down there with him. There's Beckenbauer. And now it's the new set, Kyoto, time for number 6. Aristotle. And Dr. Ian Pythagoras, and then we'll have to call him. There's Archimedes. Socrates, there he is, Socrates. Socrates, very good. And more, and more. And it will give you back the excitement at the moment. Anything else.
So you saw the five steps, the eureka, and finally the elaboration, the execution. This is, by the way, taken from their Hollywood show, if you want to take it out. It's phenomenal. Let's combine the ABCs together. Remember I talked about the importance of combining them, that it's not enough to just focus on affect, behavior, and cognition, because otherwise the flood of habits will overwhelm our attempt at change. Journaling combines them. Penny Baker, one of the most important psychologists, I'd say of the century, does a lot of work on journaling. And what he shows is that through a simple intervention, we can attain long-lasting changes. Through simple intervention, long-lasting changes that make a significant difference in people's lives. What he asked subjects to do was they came in, again, two groups, a control group as always, and an experimental group. The experimental group was asked to write about traumatic experiences that they had four times for 15 minutes each day. So the first day, 15 minutes about a traumatic experience. The second, it could be about the same experience or a different one. the third day again for 15 minutes, and the fourth day for 15 minutes. Very simple intervention, a total of an hour. And he had them write the following. Write continuously about the most upsetting or traumatic experience of your entire life. Don't worry about grammar, spelling, or sentence structure. This is, by the way, completely confidential, of course. In your writing, I want you to discuss your deepest thoughts and feelings about the experience. You can write about anything you want, but whatever you choose, it should be something that has affected you very deeply. Ideally, it should be about something you have not talked about with others in detail. It is critical, however, that you let yourself go and touch those deepest emotions and thoughts that you have, affect and cognition, describing a behavior, something that happened. In other words, write about what happened and how you felt about it and how you feel about it now. Finally, you can write on different traumas during each session or the same one over the entire study of 4 days. Your choice of trauma for each session is entirely up to you. Now, when he got the results back, the control group wrote about anything that they went through during the day. The results that he got initially were not good. When these people came back, and what he looked at, one of the things that he looked at was anxiety, anxiety level. The control group didn't change over the 4 days or at the end of the week when they came back. They were consistent, and he measured them then for 6 months to a year. No change for the control group. The experimental group, they started at about the same point. Remember, it was a random assignment in the study. They started at the same point, and then their anxiety level at the end of the first week actually went up. And this is when he was worried. He said, well, maybe I'm getting the opposite from what I expected. But then when he measured them again a few days later, their anxiety level went down. And it didn't just go down to the base level, it went down lower and remained that way consistently. In other words, they were initially anxious because they had just written about something that is difficult, but after a while, their anxiety levels went down and evened out, leveled out. He found that there's reduced anxiety, as I just said. Also, 50% drop over the next 6 months at the doctor's office. This is an objective measure of physical health. He measured their immune system, their antibodies. There were actually more of them as a result of this simple intervention relative to the control group. They were laughing more often. They were happier, less likely to be depressed. They were more outgoing as a result of this simple, tiny intervention. Keep this in context of how difficult it is to change. And yet an hour of intervention makes a significant difference. He did find gender differences. Both genders improved as a result of this. Men improved more. For the same reason, again, going back to the marriage study, that men benefit more because men tend to share less. And here was an opportunity for men to share more. But women also benefited from it. It was cross-gendered. And finally, it was replicated in the US, in Mexico, in Japan, and throughout Europe. Let me give you another example. Burton King from UCLA said, let's try have them write about peak experiences. And they gave them Abraham Maslow's peak experience description. Think of the most wonderful experiences in your life. I'm gonna take 1 minute. I wanna finish this because this is your response paper. Happiest moments, ecstatic moments, moments of rapture, perhaps from being in love or from listening to music, or suddenly being hit by a book or painting or from some great creative moment. Choose one such experience or moment. Try to imagine yourself at that moment, including all the feelings and emotions associated with the experience. Now write about the experience in as much detail as possible, trying to include the feelings, thoughts, and emotions that were present at the time. A, B, C, affect, behavior, cognition. Please try your best to re-experience the emotions involved. They wrote about it for 3 days, 15 minutes each day. The results, surprisingly, were very similar to Pennebaker. This is just in its infancy, started recently in 2004. Fewer health center visits after doing it, and enhanced positive mood, just like for Pennebaker. In other words, what they were doing, they were re-experiencing the peak experience, and then bringing order, bringing coherence to this experience, and more likely to experience post-peak experience order. Lasting change over time. This is going to be your response paper this week, so enjoy. See you on Tuesday.